Hello, everybody. Let me welcome you to yet another lecture of our Machine Learning for Greenhorse course. And thanks for accommodating me and meeting me again in the virtual environment. Can you see the slides? Thank you. For some reason, Zoom is not showing that it's sharing this screen. I am watching also the chat, so at any time, if you have any questions, either directly now at the beginning or during the lecture, please don't hesitate to ask, either using your voice or using the chat. So any questions at the beginning before I start? Nope. Know that I have sent a message to Piazza saying that there will be a consultation, possibility of consultation lesson on Wednesday. So if you want to go there, there is a voting with the most preferable time. So you can use that to see me at least online and deal with any problems which you might have. And if this seems to work out, we can keep doing it until the end of the end of the semester. Yep. Also, I haven't been responding for the past week, but since yesterday I'm getting better, so I assume I will start be responsive again from tomorrow or something like that. So with the deadlines being postponed by a week, I think you will not lose any time from the possibility of your work. So, lecture 9. We have discussed the generative models on the next lecture. So now we are opening a new chapter, which will consider like the model combination and specifically then combining or discussing decision trees and then combining decision trees all together. So at the end of the upcoming two lectures, you will know finally about these gradient boosted decision trees. So that's something good to look forward. But before we get to the decision trees and model combination, we need to discuss a topic which is called correlation. Like that's something what people use in common speech quite a lot, like something correlates with something and you can read it in the news and so on and so on. And it will actually be useful for us as well. So let's have a collection of random variables from x1 to xn. And what we know is that the expectation is linear in a sense that the expectation of sum of the random variables is really just the sum of expectations. And we've been using that quite a lot. But how about the variance of the sum of random variables? So that we haven't talked about, but we want to do it now. So if we have a variance of the sum of random variables, then by definition is the expectation of the value of the random variable, right, minus the expected value. So we know already that the expected value of the sum is the sum of the expectations, right? And now it's squared. So this is really from the definition. Now, because these are two sums, we can combine them together, right? And says okay, this is just like one sum, and we take xi from the first one and expectation of xi from the second one. And so now we have sum squared. So if we get rid of the square and explicitly write the product, it's the sum of all pairs of these xi minus mean xi times xj minus e xj. And now this expectation is again linear, so it will go inside. So the resulting variance is this large sum, which consists or considers all pairs i's j's, and then compute this weird quantity. This is, which is slightly like a variance, right? But not exactly. Like in variance, these two things would be the same, but this square made us to combine also I's and J's, which are not not corresponding to each other. So this value, that's usually called a covariance. So a covariance of two random variables, X and Y, is the expectation of X minus expectation of X times Y minus expectation of Y. So if we name that that part, we can say that the variance of the sum of random variables is the sum of covariances of all pairs of these variables. So this covariance, it's really like some generalization of variance itself, right? Specifically, the covariance of X and X, X with itself, that's really variance, right? And this is just an observation similarly to how the variance can be written either as expectation of X minus expectation X squared, or it can be written as the expectation of X squared minus expectation X squared, like we have shown this somewhere at the beginning of the course. And something quite similar holds also for the covariance. So we can either compute it as the expectation of this product, or if we multiply these factors, we get xy, right? Then x times expectation y, expectation x times, expectation x times y, and two expectations together. Now, all these three things are expectation x, expectation y, so two of them cancel out, and we get that the result is expectation x y minus the expectation x, expectation y. So that's not very interesting. So let's get to some more interesting things. And that's the correlation. So first, what we wanted is we wanted to start with the variance of the sum of random variables. And what we end up is that this variance is the sum of covariances, right? And these covariances, they are some quantity which we haven't interpreted yet, but don't worry, we will discuss what it means soon enough. So that's we are standing. So if the covariance of two random variables is zero, we call them uncorrelated. And otherwise they are correlated. So this covariance and the correlation somehow are connected with each other. So first, two independent random variables are uncorrelated. Why is that? Well, the covariance of two random variables, then we can write that this expectation is, I'm writing the proof in the discrete case, in the continuous case it to be the same. We just need to use the integrals. So this expectation is really sum over all possible pairs x, y, and there is the probability of the joint probability of x and y. Now, because they are independent, then this joint probability factors out into px and py. Now we can write this actually as this one sum times the second sum, right? Because these two parts, one contains only x and the other contains only y. And this is actually the expectation of x minus ex. Well, but this is zero, right? Because the expectation of x is just ex, and there's the same value as this one, right? And this is also zero, so really, we get the zero on the output. So for independent variables, their covariance is zero and they are uncorrelated. It doesn't go the other way around. It it's not like uncorrelated would imply independent. So that's not true. For example, assume as a counterexample, assume that we have a random uniform variable x, which gets a value from minus 1 to 1, and then y, which is just the absolute value of x. So they are not independent, they are extremely dependent because y can be computed from x, but it can be shown that they are in fact uncorrelated. So correlation somehow is connected with dependence, but some kind of dependence is not seen in this correlation. So when we talked about the correlation, it was just correlated or uncorrelated. So let's talk about some degree of correlation as well, right? Not just binary, but really to some level. And the most basic way how to define correlation is the so-called Pearson correlation coefficient, how it's denoted usually as R. And what it is its covariance divided by the square root of variance and of x and square root of variance of y. Now, in this row version, we are really like using the full expectation. So it's like really like the theoretical quantity. But in fact, mostly we only have the samples of the random variables, right? So if we estimate these quantities, this Pearson correlation coefficient is usually denoted as R, and it's really like a sample version of this row. So this correlation coefficient, it's really like a normalized covariance, right? So this covariance of two random variables, it gave us some number, and this quantity can be zero, and then we know zero. And if they were independent, the variables, then it's always zero. Then it can be like larger than zero or less than zero. It's not limited in any way, right? Because this is like the standard deviation of x, and that can be like any that can be of any size. So that's why when we define the correlation, we normalize it, right? So we have something like expectation, and now we have like x minus expectation of x times y minus expectation of y. We divide it by the expectation of square root of x minus ex squared. Sorry, it's like this. So the idea of this denominator is to make sure that the coefficient will be reasonably bounded. And what we will see is this will actually bound it between minus 1 and 1, right? So this correlation coefficient actually is bounded nicely. To see that, and this is just for your information, we can use a trick. I don't think I would ever with this idea, but once you have it, it's simple to verify. So we could, for some unknown reason, try to investigate what the value of this quantity is. So this is like some part of the values in the denominator of the correlation coefficient, and this is like the second half. We multiply the second one by rho, and square everything. So because this is an expectation of some squares, it's definitely larger or equal to zero. Now we will get rid of this square. So what we will get is we will get the first part squared, like, then the second part squared. And then in the middle, we will get 2 times A times B, right? So 2 times expectation of this first part and the second part. So now, what is happening? So this is actually an expectation. This is just a variance of x, right? So that's nice, and they will cancel out. This is just a variance of y. So again, they will cancel out nicely. And this is the Pearson correlation coefficient. So when you look at it, what we get is 1 minus rho squared. But that means that 1 minus rho squared is larger or equal to 0. So it means that the rho squared is less or equal to 1. So it can be proven, but it's really technical. It can be also obtained by applying the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, but I am not really sure if we have seen a vector space being constructed using the expectations. So I have an explicit proof here. But the important is just the fact that our coefficient is in this minus 1 range. So now what these values actually mean. So this correlation coefficient, it actually quantifies the linear dependence between 2 random variables. So it deals with dependence, but just with a linear dependence, right? So if the x and y quantities are linearly dependent, so one is linear function of the other one, then the correlation coefficient is either minus 1 or plus 1, depending on whether it's increasing or decreasing, right? It's not like minus 0.5 means it's increasing less. It means that if it's minus 0.5, it's decreasing, but it's not perfectly linear, right? So the less linear it is, so if the data would be like this, then this would be minus 0 point something large, 9 or something, right? Because it's nearly linear dependence, just small differences, and it's decreasing. And 0 means there is no linear dependence, so it's not possible to do something good if you try to predict y as a linear function of x. So if you look at the coefficient, why does it behave like this, right? Well, in the covariance, here you look at whether some quantity is larger than its expectation. So if it is larger for both x and y, right, it means that x is larger than expectation. Y is larger than expectation. So it means when X is increasing, Y is increasing. If, on the other hand, is the other way around, so X is less than the expectation and Y is less than the expectation, then again, it's some negative value times negative value. So again, it's going to be positive. Right. On the other hand, if, for example, X is larger than the expectation and Y is smaller, then these quantities have different sign, and the resulting quantity is negative, right? So when you look at it, then if the signs of these values are the same, it means whenever x increases, y increases, like it, there is some kind of a dependence in the same direction. Right, and then we get a positive value. And if it's the other way around, if whenever x increases, y decreases, then we get a negative quantity out of this. And that means that it's really like negatively correlated in a sense that the y decreases when x increases. But for this overall quantity to be non-zero, it means it happens systematically. Like if we have uncorrelated variables, it can happen that sometimes x is larger and y is smaller or something, but there is no systematic pattern. So on average, it's really zero. Like that's how it was for these independent random variables, right? For the independent random variables, the specific value of x and y have no dependence. Like they don't depend on each other. So in that case, we can really consider these to be independent factors, and each of them actually is zero, right? But if there is some systematic dependence, then this will not happen, and we will get some either positive or negative values. So let's look at some more examples. So in the top line, we can see that really like a perfect linear dependence really gets you a one. To see that the linear dependence gets you one is not very difficult. Right, because if we can say that y is c times x, then here when we have the expectation of x minus expectation of x times y minus expectation of y, so if you imagine that this is just c times x, this is c times x. So this is just c times this thing. So this is just c times this squared, right? And that's just c times this. So this covariance is actually just variance times c, right? And then gets these variances get canceled, and the result is really one. So for the perfect linear dependence, it's not surprising. For the remaining values, I'm just saying that it works like this. The interesting thing that the concrete direction of the dependence doesn't really matter. The only information is whether it goes up or down. That's why that is the case, because we have normalized the covariance by these square roots, right? So we have taken out the real coefficient of the dependence. We can just see whether it's linear or not. And the last bottom is the interesting one, right? Because it shows that uncorrelated doesn't mean independent. Uncorrelated just means there is no linear dependence, and actually none of these are linearly dependent. But if you compute the covariance, you'll get zero in all of these cases, even if the x and y's are extremely dependent in all these cases. Yep. So let's just skip this. So in order to deal with this, so it's nice to have a way to measure linear correlation, but it might be also interesting to be able to cover some nonlinear correlation. So to measure also the nonlinear correlations, two common ways are used. So one is the Spearman's rank correlation coefficient rho. Yep, I know the Pearson coefficient also used rho, usually when you see papers or really see some reported correlations, then usually they are reported with R or explicitly Pearson correlation coefficient rho. So even if these have the similar name, it's unfortunate, but it's true. So how this Spearman's rank correlation works? Well, it's measured on ranks of the original data. So what I mean by that is that in the original Pearson correlation, you have values like, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, and then you have something like 3, 9, 10, right? So the correlation between those two would not be perfect, because it's not really linear. However, you can also look at it by saying, okay, so whenever this value increases, this value also increases. So in a sense, it correlates perfectly, but not in a linear way. So to measure it in the Spearman's rank correlation, what we do is we like number the elements. when you sort them in an ascending order. So the rank is like the position in the ascending order. So we do that for our data. And then we compute the good old person correlation coefficient, but with ranks instead of the original data. And this measures even nonlinear dependence, right? If you consider this case on the left side, then whenever x increases, y increases. So this really gets a Spearman correlation of 1, right? Because the ranks correlate perfectly. But the Pearson correlation is not 1, right? Because it's like close to, I don't know, to this line, but it's not perfect. So for various cases, this Spearman correlation captures more non-linear correlation than Pearson one. So for example, here you can see that the Spearman correlation of that is much more closer to 1 than the Pearson correlation. And even for data like this, you can see that the quantities are really quite close to 1. So that's one way how we can include non-linearity in the correlation. The other is to use the Kendall rank correlation, tau, finally a new name. The Kendall correlation works differently. It doesn't revert back to the Pearson correlation, but instead, it really counts the number of pairs where things are increasing on one side and decreasing on one side. So this measure, this Kendall rank coefficient, measures the number of so-called concordant pairs. So it means if we have x1 or xi less than xj, then also the yi is less than yj. Right? So it's like x increased, y increased as well. Right? So that's this one. And this is like the positive correlation, right? Where things are increasing in the same direction. And from that, we subtract the so-called discordant pairs, which is like the opposite of that, right? So it's the situation where if we have xj larger than xi, then we have yj smaller than yi, right? So it means x increases, but y decreases, right? And then we decrease it here. We can actually compute it by looking at the signs, right? So we could consider all xi, xj, and then look whether xi or xj increase or decrease, and then look whether yi, yj increase or decrease, and then either add plus one if both signs are the same, or minus one when it's the opposite one, when it's the discordant case. So this this is like a clear interpretation, right? The interpretation tells us really like the ratio of the concordant and discordant pairs in the data. So there is no clear consensus whether to use the Kendall's tau or Spearman's row. You'll see both of them in various publications. I believe the Kendall one is slightly, wee bit more preferred, but really just slightly. And one good thing is that it's interpretable. So if you see that tau is 0.8, you know what it means, right? Yeah, it means that the probability of a concordant pair is 90%, while the probability of discordant pair is just 10%. Also, it can be proven that the Kendall tau converges to normal distribution faster. So it could be like more informative even for less data. As defined, of course, the range of Kendall tau is again min minus 1 range, because we divided here by the number of pairs altogether. But if there are ties, right, if a lot of xi are equal to xj, then this is neither a concordant nor a discordant pair. It's not computed any, it's not included anywhere, that which can make the range of that smaller. So there are several corrections how to deal with that, but we will not really talk about them. I'm just saying to you that they exist, and if you need them, you can look them up. So what we have seen, a linear correlation coefficient, which is just a normalized covariance. We have seen nonlinear coefficient, and the one is just the Pearson linear coefficient on ranks, and the other is explicitly computing the concordant and discordant pairs. So what does it good, what does it this do for us? How this might actually be useful also in the machine learning area. So in machine learning, the correlation is commonly used to measure of some agreement. And by agreement, I mean, if you have got two set of metrics or evaluations, then the correlation can tell you how close to each other they are. So for example, assume that you want to evaluate, you want to annotate some data set. So we have got some data, and we have got several annotators. So each annotator generates some annotations. And usually you would be like to be able to say how well do the annotators do. So maybe some of them is not as good as the others, or maybe some of them doesn't follow exactly the same rules which you wanted the annotators to follow, and then so on. So usually in these settings, what you do is you compute the correlation of the human annotations to see if the humans do the different humans do the same thing, right? So in that case, usually you have some part of the data set, and you let everybody annotate the same part of the data set, so something like this. And then on this common part, you can compute correlations. Right? How well do the different different people really correlate with each other? Like, if we are talking about correlation, it means that each annotator really needs to produce some real value, right? So one thing which you could do is, for example, in these human annotations, for example, could be star ratings, right? Maybe you have some output produced by a machine, and then each human produces 1 to 5 stars, right? And then this number of stars can be used as the random value in the for the correlation. And then if the correlation would be 1, it means number of stars given by one annotator and the other one is perfectly linear. Or if you use the non-linear coefficient, then it would at least say that the people would rank the data in the same order, right? But not necessarily give the same amount of stars. Now there are actually various things which could agree. So apart from just several human annotations, the correlation can be useful also, for example, for automatic metric and gold annotation correlation. So this is a figure from a diploma thesis from this year, which was solving handwritten recognition. So you got a data with manually written things this Prague is the capital, and so on. And because there was no data, then one of the approaches what the thesis tried was to use something called self-learning. Right, so try to learn from the data themselves, and it worked like this. It took the whole data set. It tries to predict perform the predictions for each word, and then it tried to find the top, let's say, 10% of the predictions. Now, that is of course difficult because you don't know which predictions are good and which are bad. But maybe we could find some measure which would correlate well with this quantity, right? And that's what this graph is. Like, here is how good a prediction is. And on the x-axis are various scores which we can compute without actually having access to the real gold annotations. And what we want is we want to find such an automatic measure which correlates the highest, right? Because then it will give the closest predictions to the truth. And visually you can see that actually this metric will have the highest correlation, like it will be something like 0.8 or something. I don't have the scores computed because luckily here you can really eyeball it directly from the data, but if they were more similar, then explicitly quantifying it might be a good idea, right? Or imagine that we have some task and we will evaluate it using it an F beta score. So some F score, but we don't know what the weight of the recall with respect to precision should be. And we would like to find out what would be the best metric. Well, the best metric would probably be the one which correlates with the human judgments the best, right? If somebody told us, okay, using beta 0.3 has the highest match with humans, then that's something what we would like to use for the evaluation. And for that, we can again use correlation. Right, we can look at the human evaluation of the individual dataset elements. We can consider the scores being attached to it using this metric. And then, for example, we could draw a graph like this, which shows persons R, persons correlation coefficients, for various values of beta when computing the metric using some F beta score inside. So this was the correlation stuff. We'll also compute something on the practical so that you have some idea, but this is like basic idea what the correlation and the correlation coefficient is. And we will still need it later today on the lecture. But let's put the correlation aside for a bit and let's discuss ensembling. Until now, we have always trained like a single model for each assignment. Apart from me in the competition evaluation saying, and I've combined like 10 neural networks together. But we never talked about how it can be done technically or why it is a good idea, and we do so now. So ensembling, that's a process of combining several models together with the goal of reaching better performance. And the simple yet very effective approach is to train several independent models and then combine their outputs by averaging. And really averaging for regression, it's straightforward. For classification, averaging also makes sense if we consider the outputs to be the distributions. Right, so if the outputs are distributions, we can average distributions together, right? And then we can take whatever class there is which has the highest average probability. If we don't have distributions, we can just vote, like whoever, whichever class is the most frequent wins. But usually if we have the probabilities, average the probabilities is definitely better than ignoring them. So the terminology is a bit tricky. Generally, when you say voting, Then you mean really by predicting the class which was the most often. And averaging means that you are considering the probabilities. Unfortunately, the averaging is sometimes also called voting or soft voting. So you cannot really rely when you hear voting whether the probabilities are also involved or not. Now, the idea why the averaging should work is that if the models have uncorrelated errors, and now you know what that means, right? So if the errors of the models are independent, but they don't need to be really independent, it's just enough that they are uncorrelated, then by averaging the models, these errors will cancel out. It kind of makes sense. Like if you have got one model and it generates some kind of an error for each prediction, then you have another model, it generates also some kinds of errors. Then if these errors are independent, then there is a good chance that you will actually end up closer to the beginning if you take like a random error here and then a random error here, for example. But don't worry, we will also compute this mathematically. So let's say that we have got some number of models, and the model yi predicts the correct target plus some error, right? So this epsilon I, it's like the error of the model I when predicting the data X. So the mean square error of the model, well, that's just the square of this error itself, right? So if we have M models, then the mean square error of the ensemble is the like we are averaging the outputs, which means our error is the average of our error squared. So now our assumption, we will assume that the individual errors have zero mean, that's definitely a reasonable assumption, and are uncorrelated, right? So what does it mean? Well, it means that the expectation of error for model I times the error of model J is zero, right? Because, well, uncorrelated means they have zero covariance, and this is exactly a covariance where we are using the fact that the expectation is actually zero. And so if this is true, then let's have a look at this quantity. So here we have this average of the errors. Now, because it's squared, then we get 1 over m squared here at the beginning. And here we have multiple or the product of all possible pairs of error I, error j. Now, if these are uncorrelated, then for different I and j, these are zero. So the only thing which is being left there, which stays there, is the case where I is equal to j. So that's the square of the individual errors. And the important thing is this 2 here, right? So let's take 1 over m out, and let's leave 1 over m e and inside, right? So if we have an ensemble, then each error, each model has this error, right? So on average, if we like choose a model and then measure its error, it will be 1 over m times the sum of the expectations of these errors, right? So I'm just summing all the individual model errors and then divided by m. And we can easily rewrite this as an expectation of 1 over m sum of epsilon I squared, right? Which is exactly this quantity. So if our models are uncorrelated, then the error of the ensemble is 1 over m times smaller than the average error of the original models, right? So the error actually disappears, it like goes away, right? The more models we have. So in theory, if we had like infinite models, we should converge to really like the optimum solution. So this is like the mathematics under it, showing that if we combine several models and they have uncorrelated errors, there is reason why we can expect our models to be even better. So the question is, where to get models with uncorrelated errors? For neural networks, and by that mean MLPs and all their versions, then actually training model with independent initialization is enough. The thing is, at least for nonlinear models, the loss has many local minima. So if we start in a different part of the landscape, we usually end up at a different minimum. So the models, even if they have quite similar overall performance, they behave quite differently on various inputs, and they tend to produce quite independent errors. So for MLPs, we don't do anything specific. We just train the models with different random initialization. This is unfortunately not enough for algorithms which have some convex loss functions. Like if you have like an obvious one global minimum of the algorithm, then just starting differently using different initialization is not enough because, well, all these are just converging to the same spot, right? With the neural networks, like there are many local minima, right? So if you begin something, you might go here. If you begin here, you'll end up here. If you begin here, you'll end up here, and so on and so on. So that's why for the nonlinear model, this is not a problem. So in order to also allow use ensembling for the linear models, for the ones with the convex loss functions, we will use the so-called begging. That's just a shortcut for bootstrap aggregation. And bootstrap aggregation works like this. It's not enough to have just random initialization. So what we will do is we will create random training data for each model. And we will create different data sets using so-called bootstrapping. We will be meeting bootstrapping in the next few lectures. So how does bootstrapping work? Well, we have some number of data. So when we bootstrap, it means we generate a new data set by sampling from the original data set. The new data set will have the same size as the original data set, and it's sampled with replacement. So it can happen that some of the elements in the data set are there actually multiple times, and some are completely missing. Right? So there might be some blue one, which is not really being used now. I was just lazy to do it perfectly. Now, this bootstrapping, this data set has actually this, on average, it has the same empirical data distribution, right? Because we kind of assume that there is this magical distribution, this P data, which can be used to sample data. And it was used to generate this XI, TI pairs. So if we sample from these with replacement, then it's the same as that's exactly as if we are sampling from the empirical data distribution. So the data set created by bootstrapping on average also has the same empirical data distribution. So it's like the same data set, apart from that some of the data might be repeated and some of them might be missing. And that's a good thing, because now the data sets are not identical. So the optimums of different runs of these algorithms are different. So there is like a naive idea here why it should work. So let's say that we have some original data set which contains 9, 6, and 8. And in the first resampled data sets, we have 8, and 6. So when we look at it, what we learn is that whenever it has a circle on top, it's an 8, right? Because, well, it's not 6. And we couldn't learn something like this on the original data set, because the 9 is also there, so the circle on top doesn't necessarily mean just 8. But it's probably a good rule in an ensemble, because if it's combined with the second rule, and the second rule is that if it contains a circle on the bottom, it's 8, then it might be useful. So in the second data set, let's say that we have got 2 9s and 1 8, so now the circle on the bottom has only 8. So again, we have this interesting rule. And these rules, they don't really hold in the original data set, but they are true reasonably enough. And if you combine them together, these two rules, they tell like they are able to classify 8 by like looking at some smaller parts of the digit structure. But as I said, this is really like a naive showcase why it actually should help. So that's the model. That's the model combination. By the way, what we have shown or used here is, or maybe what we can just consider, is that if we have a variance of the sum of the random variables, that was one of the questions we started with, right? Then if xi and xj are uncorrelated, then this covariance is actually zero for most part of them. So the only non-zero parts are the one when j is equal to I, right, for the covariance xi, xj. But that means that this xj is just xi. And the covariance of xi and xi, well, that's just the variance of xi. So we started originally by saying that the expectation of a sum is the sum of expectations. So actually, a variance of a sum is a sum of variances, but only if the random variables are uncorrelated. And specifically, if they are independent, then they are uncorrelated, and the variance of a sum is actually a sum of variances. And that's what we did in this model ensembling, right? Where the errors which we are interested in are actually the variances, right? So what we have is we have the variance of 1 over m times the individual models. We know that this is just because if they are uncorrelated, this is the sum of the individual variances, right? And the important fact is that the variance of c times some x, if c is a constant, is c squared times the variance of x. So it means that when this 1 over m goes out, it will be 1 over m squared. And that's exactly what happened here as well, right? And this is what helps us, right? Because one over m stays here inside, but one over m is still being cleft, and this is what makes the things smaller. So in other language, if we are interested in an average of some random variables, then the variance of an average of a random variable is actually 1 over m times the variance, I don't know, of the first one. Let's say that they are IID, right? If they have the same distribution, then if we compute an average of some random variables, then its variance is decreasing. It kind of makes sense, right? Because we know that the more and more random variables we have, then this more and more this should converge to the real expectation, right? There is this law of large numbers, which says that the average of some number of samples when m goes to infinity converges to the expectation. So it makes sense then when we look at the variance of the average that it will converge to zero, right? When the m goes to infinity. Otherwise, it couldn't really converge, right? So if it converges, it needs that the variance needs to be disappearing, and well, it actually is, right? But the fact that the variance is disappearing means that the errors of the models, of various models, will cancel out if they are independent. Okay, questions, thoughts, anything? So let's get on with our today's last topic, and that are decision trees. So the decision trees are actually quite simple machine learning models. They have little theory under them. It's more like a lot of engineering. And the idea is to partition the input space into some usually like rectangular cuboid regions, and then solving these regions with a simpler model. So there are several versions of decision trees, and we will focus on the so-called CART trees, classification and regression trees described in 1984. And so the idea is that if we want to classify like two-dimensional data somehow, for example, then we will, as we said, partition the data into various regions, and then consider each region independently, really like predicting, for example, just a single value for all data in this region. So what we will do is we will represent this partitioning with this tree. So in a tree, in a node of a tree, we will always have a condition, and the condition will contain one of the features, xi in this case, and some threshold, theta one in this case. And then all the points which have this feature larger than the fresh threshold are being handled by the right subtree, and all the data with the value less than a given threshold will be handled by the left subtree. And this goes on recursively, right? So this top node actually corresponds to this division, right? Then this node corresponds to this division, this node corresponds to this division, and this node corresponds to this division. So the question is how to build or create a decision tree. So let's say that we have a data set in the usual case, and that we are, so we have n examples, each with d dimensions, d features, and we are performing regression, so we get a real value for each of the examples. We will build the tree incrementally. So at the beginning, the tree will really be just a single node. If we have a node, then yt, like the instances t, will be the set of the training data which belongs to this node, which are being handled by this node. So at the beginning, of course, this single node contains all the data. And whenever we have some leaf, then the prediction in that leaf is just the average value of the targets, which belongs, like the average value of the targets of examples which belongs to this node, right? So for a given node T, we consider all the examples which belongs to this node, sum their targets divided by the number n, be it. So at the beginning, our tree is just a single node, and the prediction is the average of all the data. It's like a reasonable start. And then we need to train. So to decide how to create new nodes, we will use some criteria C, which will tell us how uniform or homogeneous are training examples belonging to a node T. So the criterion zero will usually mean that they are like all the same, like no differences. It's really extremely homogeneous, right? But larger the differences between the data belonging to a single node, the larger the criterion will be. For regression, our criterion will be just the sum of square errors, right? And between the data and between whatever we are predicting, right? So if we have a node and there is like some number of examples for it, then what we do is we consider what our prediction would be in this node, and then look how much this prediction differs from each of the data there, right? Really like a sum of squares of errors. Now, this criterion, sometimes it's noted mean square error, but please note that there is no averaging here. It's really sum, and it's important because otherwise it wouldn't work well. So that's what we will use to tell us how homogeneous or how same the data are. On the other hand, what is like the error for each example in some node of the tree? And so now the most interesting thing, to split a node. What we will do is we will, like to split a node, we need two things. We need a feature, like choose one of the features from 1 to D, and then choose a value, right? Once we have a feature and a value, we can imagine how the split would look like, right? We would say, okay, if xi is larger than theta, then this would go to the left, otherwise it would go to the right. So if we have a feature and the value, we also know how the split would look like, and then we can actually compute what the criterion in the left and the right subtree would look like. So what we will try to do is we will try to find such split, so such a feature and a value, that if we perform the split, then the criterion of the left and the right subtree is the lowest, right? So what I've just described is like a greedy algorithm, which in each time step tries to find such a split that the data are as most homogeneous as possible, right? That makes sense because it means we want to do a split such that if we perform a prediction on these the training data, it would be as low as possible, right? Because at least the criterion here is really the sum of squares of the errors. So what we will actually want is we will want the criterion to decrease the most, right? This had some kind of a criterion. Now we have the sum of those criterions. And so by splitting, we probably helped us, right? So the criterion of the split it to nodes is now lower than before. And we want this to like be the lowest, to decrease as most as possible. And this is really all there is to decision tree. It's really like a lot of engineering stuff and little theory. We just, whenever we want to add a new node to the tree, we just consider all possible splits, so all features and all values, measure the effect, so compute the criterion, like how our error will decrease, and then just choose whatever possibility is the best. Now, in practice, we usually have several constraints, not for the tree to grow to be extremely large or something. So the usual constraints are some maximum depth of the tree. So we can say, okay, let the depth of the tree be at most 5. This means our tree will not grow indefinitely. We could also say that we only want to split a node if it contains at least some number of examples, right? Because we have seen that overfitting is bad, and then learning things just for the individual examples might not be a great idea. So we could say, okay, we only split the nodes which contains at least, I don't know, 3 examples or something. Or alternatively to the maximum tree depth, we could say that we want to limit some number of leaves, right? So the tree depth definitely limits the number of trees, leaves, like the 2 to the depth. It also goes the other way around, but not ideally. So the overall tree is usually built in one of two ways. So if we don't limit the number of leaves, so if this is not here, then we really just use a depth first manner, right? So we just split the root node, then we recursively split everything into the left subtree and then everything in the right subtree. And usually we use this first constraint, the maximum tree depth, to stop the recursion and otherwise just really create all possibilities. On the other hand, if we give the maximum number of leaf nodes, then we cannot just say that we will split everything on the left side and then only go to the right side, because, well, splitting on the left side might use all available possible leaf nodes without considering the right side, but there may be some great split which could be done on the right hand side. So if we specify the number of leaf nodes, then usually we split not in the depth first manner, but in more like some graph algorithm like manner, where we consider all possible leaves and split such leaf which will give us the most. And what we mean is that the criterion will decrease the most. So it was bad before, and after splitting, it will be great. So when this difference is the largest, that's the node which we will do. Yep. I will skip over pruning for the time being. And this is really all there is to the regression tree, right? We perform prediction by navigating the tree and then just saying whatever value is stored in the leaf. And during training, we just greedily split the node so that the criterion is the lowest in each time step. Yep. So that was for regression. For classification, it will be quite similar. During prediction, what we will do, or if we have a leaf and we have some examples belonging to that leaf, then if we need to predict a class in this leaf, well, we will predict the class which is most frequent in the training example belonging to the node. That kind of makes sense. The question is how to define the criterions. It was just a square error there. So now what we will consider, so we will consider two of them. And before computing these criteria, what we will do is we will define PTK. And PTK, that's the probability of class K of examples which belonging to the node T, right? So if I were to write this explicitly, then here we would divide it by the number of training examples belonging to this root node. And here we would have such an example belonging to the tree that there its target, the I is K, right? Something like this. Really like the empirical probability of an example belonging to the node T of having a class K. So two criteria. The first criterion which is being used is the so-called Gini index, or sometimes also called Gini impurity. The Gini, that's the name of the mathematician who came up with this criterion. And it measures like an error in this sense. Assume that we have chosen an element randomly from these elements which we have there. And we consider instead labeling it randomly according to the PT. And the probability that these two differ, like the probability of the prediction of the class and that the probability that we will actually draw the same class from the training data, well, then that's exactly the Gini index. And what the Gini index is the for each class, we take the probability of that class appearing in the training data times 1 minus the probability. And we sum this for all possible classes. Yep. And we then weight this, because this is really just the probability, then we multiply it by the size of the set so that we really have the information about the size of the set included. So this is like a weird thing which just appeared out of nowhere. The other criterion will be obvious, and it's just the entropy criterion. So we will compute the entropy of the probability distribution of the classes in this node, and we will again multiply it by the number of training examples. So all the criteria, as you have seen, actually include the information of the size of the set, right? So this is like the mean square error, but it's not mean, it's actually sum of square errors. So these two criteria are also like sums, right? Some quantity, but the larger the training set, the larger this criterion is. So with the entropy criterion, definitely makes sense, right? Because if the entropy would be zero or very small, it means the PT will look like this. And that's what we want. We actually want the training examples belonging to a single node to have very little entropy, because then we'll make small mistake. And this doesn't measure explicitly entropy, but this Gini index. And what you can do is you can consider it to be a variance, right? You can consider this to be a variance of the individual classes, right? Because the variance is phi times 1 minus phi for a Bernoulli distribution. So both of these seems to make sense. So you know me, I don't like things appearing out of blue sky. So it would be nice to have at least some idea, like why these things just got here. Well, luckily, it will be quite straightforward. So we can actually derive the binary genie from just the square error loss, which will be nice. So let's have some number of training examples belonging to node T. And now we are considering binary genie. So let's say that we have NT0 examples with target value 0 and NT1 examples with target value 1. So let PT, PT1, be the probability that the target value is actually 1 among our examples, right? So it's like sum of the targets, 0 or 1s, and then divided by the number of examples. We can, using our newly defined values, also compute it as NT1, examples with target value 1s, divided by all of the examples, which is NT0 plus NT1. And now consider the sum of squares loss. So it's loss where we give it some probability, and it gives us the sum of squares between the probability and the target value in our data. Let's try minimizing it. So in order to minimize this loss, we compute the derivative and set it to 0. So the derivative of this looks like sum over I 2 times p minus ti. We set it equal to 0, which means we can cancel this. And we get sum over I of p should be sum over I of ti. Now, this is the same element summed over and over, so we can write that this is just p times as many examples as there are. And it just says, okay, the probability which minimizes the square loss, well, that's just this pt value. So the probability of a target value 1 in our training set. Well, definitely makes sense, right? If you want to minimize the, find the probability which is closest to the target variables, well, then their average is what it should be, right? But formally, we can do it. And now, this was straightforward, but what about the value of the loss? What will the value of the loss be, the one which is the minimum one? Well, that's the one to which we can, which we will use PT and compute its value, right? So let's do it. Let's compute the square of errors for this PT and all the targets. So this sum, it contains some number of elements where the target is 0, NT0 of them. And then it contains some number of elements, NT1, where the target is 1. So instead of a sum, we can have just two terms. Now, the PT, we know what it is, right? It's just NT1 over NT0 plus NT1. So this blue part is just this blue part. And it was squared originally, so it's squared even now. Similarly, PT minus 1, right? That's the same thing as 1 minus PT squared. And 1 minus PT, the PT is the probability of target 1, so the remaining part, 1 minus PT, that's the probability of the target value 0, right? There are no other possibilities. So we can compute it as NT0 divided by NT0 plus NT1, and again squared. So now we will just put these on the to the common denominator. We always have NT0, NT1 here, and here we have NT1, and here we have NT0. So this is what we get. And now we can realize that this green part, that's just 1 minus pt, and the red part is pt. And nd0 plus nt1 is just the number of examples. So this is just number of examples times pt times 1 minus pt, which is, oh, surprise, the Gini index, right? So the Gini index is actually just the smallest possible value of the loss, which is just the square error over the probabilities. So nothing actually new. We haven't used the mean square error on probabilities for classification models, but it could be done. And if we did it, we would get exactly this criterion. So what about the entropy criterion? What do you think? Well, the entropy criterion is just the consequence of using the negative log likelihood loss. So let's see that. Let IT be the examples which corresponds to a node T, and let NTK be the number of examples with the target value K, so with the class K, right? And then PT is like the probability distribution of our examples. So PTK is the number of examples with the class K divided by all of the examples. And consider as a loss, like negative log likelihood, the sum of negative log likelihoods of all the examples. That's a natural loss, which we have used most of the time. And so what will happen? Well, the same thing as on the previous slide will happen. So first, we will show that minimizing this loss can be done by using this PT, right? So if we need to predict something for all these examples, then it should really be just the distribution of their labels. And then we will show that the value of this loss with this PT will be the entropy criterion, right? So that's the plan. So first, let's compute the minimum of this. Well, to compute the minimum of that, we will compute the derivative. So the derivative of that sum over I is minus, and logarithm of something is 1 over di. But that's not enough, because we want to minimize this with respect to a distribution. So we, in fact, need to form a Lagrangian, right, by including the constraint lambda times sum over c b c minus 1, right? So if we include this into our derivative, we also get minus lambda. From this, we get that the okay, so now I said that the derivative of this is 1 over pti, and that's the truth in case this ti is the class which we compute the derivative with, right? So assume that we compute the derivative of our loss with respect to pk, right? So we get this here for such I that ti is k, or I can just say pk. So we get here minus 1 over pk, and we get it there as many times as the class of some example is k. Well, that's n dk exactly, right? And then we have minus lambda. So now let's reorder things a bit. So let's put lambda to the other side. Let's multiply by pk divided by lambda, and we get that the pk is minus n dk divided by lambda. So the best probability is proportional to the number of examples. Well, then that thing which we have here, that's exactly it, right? Which is also properly normalized. So lambda actually could be computed from this, and we could see that this is actually the correct minimum. I mean, like the distribution where the loss has minimum, and then the loss with the value of the loss with respect to this pt, well, that's just the sum of the negative log of these ptis. So this pti, when we go over the classes, well, for each class k, we have that many examples there as there are training examples in the training data. For each, we have the logarithm of their probability. And that's exactly the entropy multiplied by the size of the set. Woo-hoo! So it seemed like we have two new weird losses, but they are just the good old losses. And the square entropy, the square error criterion for the regression can be derived using the same approach from the good old mean square error. So at least these things are the same. So, and that's all for the classification trees. And we'll discuss the last section for today's slides, just three of them more, and that's random forests. We have seen that, or talked about, that combining models can help us, especially with the decision trees, where the individual decision trees are quite poor, actually, not very powerful models. Combining multiple of them might be a good idea. So that's what we will do. We will combine multiple trees. And we will call this ensembling of decision trees random forest, right? The forest because it contains lots of trees. Ha, it's funny. So how does it work? It combines two techniques to create this random forest. First is begging. We have already seen that. That's the bootstrap aggregation. So we will train each tree by using a bootstrap dataset. Right, so for each tree, we will sample a data set with repetition from the original training data and just use it as a training data. Then we will use some second improvement, random subset of features. So the second improvement is the following. Well, in order to make the predictions of the individual trees as uncorrelated as possible, like we want to increase variance in a sense, like the variance in what the models can do. But sometimes one specific feature might be really obvious one to be chosen during splitting. So we will try to play some, disallow that, so to add some randomization also to the splitting. And what we will do is that for each node independently, we take only a subset of features which we consider for splitting, right? So at some point we might say, okay, we are not going to consider X1 in this node, and then find the best split using the available features. We split, then in another node, we will draw another set of features, which we will disallow. But this time, maybe X1 will not be disallowed. So the features which are important will not be banned for long, but it might happen that the decision tree will decide to split by some not such a great feature first before by splitting by some other one. And this, it can be shown that this on average shouldn't really change the error. of the trained model, but it definitely changes the variety of the models which can be trained. And that's really all there is to random forests. Now, the last thing is how to perform prediction. So for prediction, we have a data, we find its prediction in the individual trees, and we combine them. And we combine them by averaging for regression and by the hard voting for classification, because we don't have probabilities, we only know class from each of the trees, right? But usually one creates something like 100 random trees, so even voting will probably be fine in this case. Yep. So that's all I have there for you. So are there any questions at the end? If not, thank you very much for your attention. I'm looking forward to meeting you on the tomorrow's practicals, where we will talk about the assignments. So see you all there, and have a nice Monday until then. Thanks, see you.